I'm Monica Bowman. My age is 70. Today's date is April 12, 2019. We're in Cookeville, Tennessee, and I'm talking with my spouse.
And I'm Henry Bowman, age 72. Today's date is April 12, 2019 in Cookeville, Tennessee, and I'm with my spouse. Well, here today to talk about primarily about my incident, which happened August 28th, 2008. I got up that morning to do my usual morning exercise. I was out walking. I began to feel suddenly very tired. And so I cut my walk short, and I came back into the house, and I told Monica I wasn't feeling very well. And I didn't know what was wrong, but I was not having the typical heart attack symptoms. I was just feeling tired and just worn out. Then I went in to take a shower to get ready to go to work, and I came out of the shower, my head was sweating. And that was the time Monica got onto it. She said, "You got something seriously wrong. What do you want to do?" I said, "Well, maybe you can just take me to the hospital." She worked at the local hospital. And she said, she had the good sense to say, "No, I'm going to call EMS," which she did. And the EMS workers got there in about 6 minutes, which is remarkable. And I got up and I walked out into the ambulance on my own, lay down on the cot. Just perfectly relaxed, no particular problem. And then one of my neighbors came over who happens to be a nurse, and she later told us that I looked pretty bad. But anyway, we were in the ambulance, and they took off. They did they did an EKG on me, and Monica told me later that she was trying to get the technician to say, did it look bad or whatever, and he was very hemming and hawing about it. He didn't have much to say, and later on we found out he'd actually taken two EKGs because the first one he couldn't believe. It was so unusual. So anyway, I went on to the hospital, and even as we rode over there, I was just lying there very calmly. I'm sure they had me doped up by that time. But watching the trees, trying to figure out what street they were taking, that sort of thing. And then we drove up to the hospital, and I passed out. And that's the last thing I remember for 12 hours. Then Monica took over.
And so I was registering him, and one of the people, I worked at this hospital. I was a social service worker, and one of the people that I knew came to let me know that the doctor wanted me to know that he'd had to be resuscitated, and then they came back and said that he'd had to have on a ventilator. So things were not going well, and I was there alone. But in any event, it wasn't long before people came to me. They kept telling me that the doctor was going to come to tell me what was going on, but he didn't, because he was actually very busy saving his life at that moment. But they took him up to have a cardiac cath done. And so I went, and there was a very small waiting area, but people from across the hospital came to be with me. And so at one point, the doctor did finally come out, and he asked me some quick questions. Did he have diabetes? No. Did he have any kinds of heart disease? And the answer was no. And so then later the doctor came again, and he told me then that they were having to resuscitate him every 3 seconds. They said that they would resuscitate him, he would come back, and then he'd go out again in 3 seconds. And they were doing this continually. And so I asked the doctor, is he going to die? And he said, we're trying to stabilize him so that he can have surgery. Then a little bit later on, I heard them page over the hospital paging system for the cardiac surgeon. Now, I worked at this hospital and had worked there a very long time, and I knew that that was something that just was not done. They just didn't, they did not routinely at all page the cardiac physician to come to cardiac cath lab. They did it twice. I didn't hear it the first time, but all the people in the room who were with me heard it, and then I heard it the second time. So the doctor had said, we're trying to stabilize him. Well, they never did stabilize him. They did bring him out of the cardiac cath area, and they said that I could come see him, and I did. And there, he was lying there on the gurney, and there were people all the way around this gurney, and the main doctor was pumping on his chest. So it wasn't that he was ever stabilized. He just... But they took him down to surgery anyhow. And so this went on for several hours. And toward the end of the day, a friend of mine came back to let me know that he had done well, and they were finishing up the surgery. Well, then another nurse came to say, well, that wasn't exactly true. So even at all this had started before 7 in the morning, and this was now 3:30 or 4 in the afternoon, and this other nurse said, well, there still were some issues, but in fact, he did finally make it through, but they'd had to resuscitate him throughout the day. At that time, I had heard that maybe they had resuscitated him as many as 30 times, which is just unheard of, but I didn't know that for a fact. Friends had come. Henry's family had come. They lived about 100 miles away, and I learned later that my friends who called them told them to bring funeral clothes. And they did, but they didn't have to use them. So anyhow, Henry came through the surgery. And then that night, he was in the cardiovascular ICU. It wasn't visiting hours, but there's some advantage to having worked at the place because they let us in. My brother had come with my mother, who was in early Alzheimer's, and his wife, my brother's wife. And so we asked if we could come in and see him, and they did, of course, let us come in. And so the nurse who was working was a nurse that I knew from day shift, but he happened to be working nights that night, and so that was very comforting to me that there was someone there that I knew. And so he let us come in, and he told me to tell Henry to move his foot, and I did, and Henry did. And then he said, tell him to squeeze your hand, and I did, and Henry did. Now remember that I was thinking that, you know, you'd been resuscitated maybe 30 times. So there was a huge question in my mind about whether your mind was still with us. But that was the first indication that you understood and could respond. So let's stop here and talk about Rumpole of the Bailey for a minute. You want to tell that part of the story?
Oh, surely. Rumpole of the Bailey, as you probably know, was a PBS station broadcast that involved this British barrister who was sort of a curmudgeonly character, who had a very overbearing wife called Helga.
Hilda.
Anyway, he called her She Who Must Be Obeyed. So I started calling Monica that many years before all this happened, and it turned out to be appropriate under the current circumstances because she's the one that called the ambulance and I had to go when she did that.
Henry's always called me She Who Must Be Obeyed for a very long time, even bought me a sweatshirt that said that on it one time. So the first time I was She Who Must Be Obeyed was that morning when he said, you can take me in the car, and I did not even discuss it with him. It was just a matter, no, we're going to call EMS, and that was fortunate because before he ever left our driveway, he already had oxygen, so he was never without oxygen. They also had given him morphine, which helps to helps dilate the veins, and they give him other medicines so that he was receiving treatment before he ever left our driveway. And the important thing was that he was never without oxygen. So that was that. And then when we got to see him that night, and he squeezed my hands, and he shook his foot. Do you remember what you said about that later?
No, I don't.
And so later you said, "Well, I always do what you tell me to do, so why would I not have done that then?" So I was still she who must be obeyed. I told him to squeeze my hand, and he did squeeze my hand. And
how did that feel? Can you tell Henry how that felt when you felt him squeeze your hand?
Well, it was just such a relief that it looked like he was there. That Henry's a very smart person. He's an economist and just is a very smart person. And during the day, you know, I wondered what's going to happen here and what's going to happen to his mind, and is he going to be with us? So that was my first indication that he was there.
Well, when she asked that, I said, "Well, why not? I mean, who wouldn't be able to squeeze your hand or who couldn't wiggle your toes, you know?" It just because I was perfectly aware of what was going on. Only discomfort was that thing they stick in your mouth.
He was on a ventilator. And so he couldn't talk at that point.
But it worked out very well, obviously. It's been over 10 and a half years now.
So the next morning...
Where are we?
Well, I'll okay. So the next morning... Let me remind you about this. The cardiac doctor had told me that he would call me about 6:30 the next morning, and I did go home. I spent the night at home, and I think actually your sister and our niece were staying there too, as I recall, though that was a long time ago. But anyhow. So that next morning, I did not get the call from the doctor, and so that concerned me. So I waited maybe 15 or 20 minutes past the time he said he would call me, and I called the hospital then, and I talked to the nurse, who, again, I knew it was the same one who had taken care of you all night, and he said you were doing fine, and the surgeon actually happened to be there. He got on the phone. He said, "Come on over. He's doing fine." So that was just so comforting to know. So we got up and got dressed and went to the hospital pretty quickly. Later on, I saw one of the cardiologists, and he was the one who told me that over the course of that day, you were resuscitated 62 times. He said, "I knew it was a lot of times." He said, "So I actually looked it up." We learned later that 8 of those times was just on the ambulance, on their equipment, and the distance from where you were when you first passed out till where you came into the hospital it was just several feet. It was not that long, but you were already going in and out very, very quickly. And then your doctor told me 62 times. So anyhow, you recovered. You made it out of the hospital. And one of the next interesting things, I think, that happened was that we were at home one afternoon. Do you remember? They called us from the ambulance service. And yes. They said that there was kind of I don't know if they called it a competition or what it was. But this...
Well. What they do, each their 9 regional ambulance organizations, I guess, in the state, and each of them gets to nominate their 3 best saves. Still have to be living. And these are submitted to an independent person in Nashville who doesn't know anything about any of these people. And they called back Randy Porter, who's the EMS director here at that time, and said, I've got to see this guy. So we were invited down to that program.
It was a banquet. It was a very nice banquet.
Yeah, it was. There must have been 300 people in there.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, they were telling the stories about each of us, and they sort of exaggerated a little bit. They said, I fought them getting into the ambulance. I really didn't. But when they mentioned the 62 resuscitations, you could hear a gasp and then silence, because these people never heard of such a thing. And these were all EMS workers. So I thought that was kind of an interesting effect. It apparently is very unusual.
What that banquet was, it was really a wonderful opportunity, because they invited the people who were saved and their family, an immediate family member, and they invited all the people from the EMS part of the equation that were involved in your stay or involved in your save. In this situation, we called them about maybe, it probably was 6:30 in the morning. And so the crew came. And so at this banquet, there were the dispatchers who were involved, and there was more than one, because shift change was at 7. And then there was one crew that came first. And I remember hearing them talk on their communication devices that there was going to be another, that they needed to have another crew come. So a second crew came. But all those people were there in Nashville at this banquet, so we got to meet with them. And one of the really neat opportunities is that I was able to talk to that emergency tech, emergency professional, who I had asked, when I saw he was looking at your EKG, I asked him, how does it look? And he was absolutely quiet. And then I asked him the second time, does it look like it's a heart attack? And he started kind of fussing, he was
hemming and hawing,
yeah. And he said, well, the tracings appear that it might be. So at this banquet that night, he said, I was looking for anything good on that EKG, and there was nothing. So they knew, you know, right off the bat, they knew how bad you were and how quickly it was necessary for you to get to the professionals. And our EMS service is just phenomenal, because they're connected into the hospital. So the folks at the hospital already knew what to expect. They probably already had the cardiac cath team called and ready to go. So that was nice. And it was nice to meet these people, because they were the ones that began that road toward saving your life.
That's right. I remember that well. They were very nice people, and just glad they were there and handy.
Yeah, yeah. Some people like living out in the country. We're so glad that we did not live out in the country. We live in town, and we were close to the hospital, and I was very pleased about that.
And a little bit of an aside to this story is, several years after that, or before that rather, there was a movement up front to sell this hospital. And this hospital is locally owned by our city. It's a municipal hospital, which is very unusual these days. But in fact, the city council had voted to sell it. But there was a referendum brought forth, and the people voted it down just very narrowly. And that was, I can't help thinking, what would have happened had we sold this hospital? I think we might have just turned into a feeder hospital for a larger group that might have bought it. So I feel very grateful for that. So that turned out very well for me in this case.
Yeah, we have an excellent heart program, and
yes,
other programs too, but certainly the cardiac program. I think if they had been unable to treat you there and you had to go 90 miles to Nashville, I don't believe you would have survived.
No.
So
I would not have made it, you know, 20 miles out of town.
Yeah.
I'm convinced of that.
Yeah. So we were very thankful that the hospital was good. They reinvest their earnings into the hospital and have a wonderful cardiac program even now. So they saved your life.
What did you think? Why is it so important, you think, that it's community owned?
Because it's not profit driven.
It's not. It's a community-owned hospital. It is not profit-driven, though they certainly need to make enough to keep the doors open. But extra, you know, I don't want to call it extra funds. You're the economist. The money goes back into the hospital for
yes.
additional services and to continue to update our equipment and all.
Is there something special also about people in the community working in that community-owned hospital?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it is very nice that we have people employed in the hospital who are local and from other counties in the region. This is a relatively poor area, poor part of the state of Tennessee, and that's sort of what I specialize in. We have many people who commute in here from other counties who work. I think the hospital now has about 2,300 employees, which is quite large for a city this size. And we are, the whole city of Cookeville only has about 33,000 people. So we're very lucky to have that here.
When we think about our friends and neighbors, you know, the fact that I had had worked at the hospital, it was not long before that little waiting room that I was in was completely full of people. I think the word had gotten around the hospital that I was leaving without a husband that day, but lo and behold, you continued to do your part. They continued to resuscitate you, but you were doing your part because you kept coming back even when, you know, your body was saying, nope, this is it, but it clearly wasn't your time yet. So what do you think, Henry, about this is 10 and a half, we're going on 11 years later. What do you attribute your continued health, good health, to?
Well, we have what I think is an excellent cardiac rehab program here for this community. And I've been very faithful about attending that. I go there 5 days a week, work out for about 45 or 50 minutes every morning.
And what time do you go?
I go about 6 in the morning, usually between 6 to 6:15. And the personnel there are so nice, and it just makes it easy. They're like friends now. So I don't have much trouble getting up to do it. So it's works out very well for me.
Yeah, I've been impressed with how well you've done. And when you go, you actually work at it pretty hard.
Yes.
You did sustain damage on your heart, which
Absolutely.
Would be certainly understandable given that you were resuscitated 62 times. But I think the reason that you're doing as well as you have is that you exercise so faithfully. There are probably other things we could do, like eating better. We don't do that as well. But
yes,
but
we could work on that.
That's right. But you do exercise, and the exercise, the cardiac rehab program allows people, even after the time that their insurance has stopped, to continue to pay to participate in it. And so you've been very faithful with doing that. I guess the only times you've missed have been the very few times you've been sick or if we've been on vacation. So
that's right.
So that's been nice. Is there anything else about this that we wanted to kind of keep a record of?
Do you remember the first thing that you thought when you woke up in the hospital?
Well, actually, when I first woke up, I thought, what is this thing in my mouth? And, well, I've got this, I probably shouldn't say this. I saw my wife across there. Oh, I said, what an angelic being. Then I saw my mother-in-law. No. So,
that's a joke.
That's a joke, yes. So, But I couldn't ask for better treatment. And all this sort of raises the question of what are small communities doing for hospitals these days? We just had one recently closed in a nearby county that only has about 7,000 people in the whole county, and they had 150 people employed up there. And it's a big loss. It's a big blow to that little community. And we've seen rural hospitals all across Tennessee going out of business for various reasons, Medicare reimbursement and whatever, or Medicaid. And it's just kind of a depressing situation in a lot of ways. And I'm just glad I live near this one.
Well, I think you've done very well through the years. You've continued to exercise. We're active. You don't come home and just sit and not do anything. You're still working a couple of hours, 5 days a week, and that's a good thing, I think, for you and for the community, because you still have numbers to give people. You've still got economic numbers that people need and want.
Yeah, I work with a lot of people, a lot of chambers of commerce, these small chambers who have no resources and are not particularly statistically informed, and I try to keep these people up to date on basic statistics about the area. And we also do plans and grant work for these communities, and all those generally involve some sort of statistical analysis of data. And that's what I do, and I like doing that kind of thing. So I'm glad to do that even at my advanced age for retirement. I still hang in there, and gives me something to do.
Yeah, it's a good thing to do. So I think the final thing I would want to say is to remember about she who must be obeyed. If you've got somebody who looks like there's even the smallest chance that they're having heart problems, don't let them talk you into taking them in the car. Call 911. You must be she who must be obeyed so that they will have a chance to live.
And I'd like to reiterate the point that I didn't have the classical symptoms, no elephant on the chest, no pain in the arm, none of that stuff that one normally associates with male heart attacks. So I'm just lucky that she who must be obeyed called the ambulance and got me going, because I really thought I could just go into the ER and have it checked out. But that just was not the case.
Well, we've had 10 and a half years as of right now that I didn't think we would have. I mean, that day, if you had told me that you would still be alive in 10 and a half years, I wouldn't have thought that was the case. So I think we're very fortunate that we've had this time. You've had excellent medical care, and you have done your part, and I think that's wonderful.
Well, I can't say enough, as I said before, about the treatment I've gotten here from the EMS workers, from the hospital doctors and nurses, and the cardiac rehab program I've been in. All have been just top-notch as far as I'm concerned.
Another facet that we talked about a little bit was about the bit about the hospital potentially being sold. I remember that time. It happened many, many years ago, and several years ago before your event. But the hospital had been city-owned, but like you said, the city council did vote to sell it. I'm sure they were looking at all the dollar signs that the various companies were offering, because several of the companies, there were just several companies that wanted to purchase our hospital. And we had a state senator who got on the side of those of us who did not want to sell the hospital. And he somehow in the state legislature had it fixed so that the hospital could not be sold without a referendum by the people. And do you remember that part of that referendum, to getting it on the ballot, there had to be signatures from people who were Cookeville City residents. And I remember at the hospital, those who wanted to took these petitions so that we could get people to sign them to say that they wanted there to be a vote for whether the hospital would be sold or not. And you and I went up and down one street and then another street, and we did this several nights, getting people to sign petitions. And most of the people that we talked with agreed to sign those petitions, saying that we should not sell, or that we should vote on whether we sell the hospital. And so we went through that process, and then there was the vote, and lo and behold, they decided not to sell the hospital. But to this day, that legislation exists that says that the hospital can't be sold without a referendum. So I think that's interesting.
One of the ironic parts of this, well, it's not really ironic, but just before this referendum came to vote, one of the most beloved doctors in this community died, and he was a big advocate for supporting the hospital and keeping it under city control. And the vote was so close, I've always suspected, had he not died, it would have gone the other way.
He was a very much beloved doctor, and he was totally supportive of the hospital, and that was very helpful, I think. We haven't, but I can talk to that, though. So, you know, fortunately, neither of us has ever had to be in a big city hospital somewhere where we were being treated for something that couldn't be handled at our regional hospital here. But through the years, I worked as the social service worker at our hospital, and I would talk to people who had been to big city hospitals. And so often I would hear them say that they thought the care here was much better. You had more of a personal touch from people, that you really could see the difference in terms of the kind of care and the quality of care that was provided here. So that was another indication, I think, that we did well to keep our hospital under local control.
And not only that, simply the number of people you have monitoring patients is much larger here than a typical big city hospital.
Yeah, yeah.
So, is there anything else that you would like to say before we close out?
I don't know of anything. Let's see. We got everything covered.
Yeah, we went over everything on the list.
Okay.
So I think that's probably enough.